Welcome to episode 30 of Extinction Radio. We're being broadcast now on activatemedia.org, noon Pacific time, 8 p.m. UK time. I'm Gene Gibson, along with my co-hosts Ivy Cohn and Peter Melton. Carolyn Baker is traveling this week and wasn't able to be involved. We're going to have interviews with Michael Azima and Paul Beckwith, and our usual contributions by Solomon Amuzu and John Compost Kossum, and the extreme weather by Ivy Cohn, and of course my musical gems. And we all love the poet laureates of doom, including Benjamin the Donkey.
You know, we're kicking the can down the road while watching our morals erode. We're waiting to see how long it will be before we're swirled down the commode. That's why I listen to Extinction Radio. Hee-haw!
And now, Peter Melton will be interviewing Michael Azima. His interview on the 20th went so well, we did another one. Peter? Michael?
Hello there, Extinction Radio. It's Peter Melton with this week's main interview of Michael Azima. We had Michael on recently for a quick little 10-minute interview, and it was so much fun, we thought we'd better have him on for a longer stretch to get deeper into the mind of someone who wrote a book called Funny God and a whole bunch of others. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here, Peter.
Yeah, boy, interesting times for sure, and you've been documenting these times. Give us again a quick recap of what you've done with your life, for God's sakes, young man.
Well, I've been on a long journey to find out what the truth is, I was a child of the 60s, and it was a very troubled time. Everything was changing, and we didn't know what the truth was. You know, the Vietnam War and everything was telling us that a lot of things we were told about our lives and our country and everything were false. And so there was a great awakening for a lot of us, and we found out a lot of things about our culture was just not right. It was off. And so we had a generation that wanted to find out what the truth was, and I was one of those. And so I set off on that direction. I pursued many things academically and experientially, and I ended up going deeper into myself after activism and anti-war activity and all kinds of other things like that. I wanted to go deeper into myself to, you know, we wanted to make a better world, you know, and part of that, you know, following John Lennon and so many of those of our generation who wanted to do that. And even John Lennon went off into primal therapy. Well, so did I, not just to follow him, but because I was already on that path. And it was all about trying to make ourselves better. So, because we knew that physician heal thyself, we knew we had to take care of ourselves first. So that started me on my path. And that's maybe a lot about what happened in my beginnings, but it led to the rest of my life, which was all about adding to that academically, experientially. I became a primal therapist. I became a holotropic breathwork facilitator. I taught in the universities. I pursued things academically. And I was writing this whole time. I wanted to share what I was knowing, but I was waiting, because I learned early on, something I heard early on when I was studying philosophy. Somebody said, first thing before you go teaching or writing books or whatever is have something to say.
Well, that does seem to be an important aspect if you're going to be writing a book.
So I wasn't about to just put things out there. I wasn't in it for any money or anything or for fame or any ego reasons. I really, my major motivation in life is I want to help. There's reasons why I would feel that way. I guess I grew up having a lot of compassion for the people around me because of the things I saw. And I grieved a lot in my life for people that were close to me. In a lot of ways, I had it better than them. And and I wanted to help. And so I spent my life with, you know, in those feelings. And so it wasn't about the money or anything. Like a lot of my generation, I was very idealistic. I wanted to find out what the problems were, and then I wanted to do something about them. Yeah. So I spent my life doing that. And then as when it came to the books, it's like I wanted to, when I had something to say, I wanted to make sure that it was right. So I spent a lifetime looking into these things. Now I've got, and in the last 2 years I put out, well, it'll be eight books in a few weeks. Because I'm finally putting out what I've learned over all these years. And it's in so many areas.
Yeah. We're talking to Michael Adzema, Adzema, a prolific author, but also very deep into experiential activities and the depth of grief work and breath work, and also having a very clear and present perspective on our current situation. Tell us what you're feeling about where you find us now in 2015.
I find us in dire straits. And I guess my main thing is I want to see some kind of activist response. I haven't given up hope. I know that it looks bad. You know, if you look at if you crunch the numbers, we don't have much chance. But still, I think that this is a grand opportunity to do something. I think that the best response to an emergency is a heroic action, especially when other people's lives are on the line. You know, we got loved ones. It's not just our own demise we're talking about. We're talking about that of the innocents, you know, the babes, the children. You know, do we really want to just, you know, give up the world and let them suffer or not suffer an untimely death or just not to get to live out the kind of lifespan that we enjoyed? I don't think we do. I can't imagine any parent not wanting to throw their own life on the line, throw their own life in front of a moving car if they could save their child. And we're in that kind of a situation right now where things are so bad. And I don't see why, if people were to understand how serious it is, they wouldn't do everything in their power. I mean, not to get that extra dollar or that promotion or whatever, to save the planet, to put some energy into consciousness raising, to do whatever their skills would allow them to do. The thing is that we are in such a strait. This goes far beyond the danger of the last world war. Last world war, you know, yeah, millions died, millions were killed, but it's nothing like the end of all life on this planet. I mean, we are talking, with the radiation filling the globe, you know, that's 25,000 years. Some of this radiation, the plutonium, has to be guarded for 25,000 years. You know, this is just the nuclear waste. 25,000 years has to be guarded. And for 250,000 years, it's deadly. Now, what are we screwing with here? How dare we? How dare we doom 25,000 years into the future? You know, like, and do we really think there's going to be any future for anybody on this planet when we're doing that? We're putting that our planet in that kind of a situation. I mean, it's not just humans that die from radiation; it's all life. Yeah. There's only a few minor microorganisms that can live around around radiation.
Right. So we've taken some steps. We've been, we've been in over our heads. We've not been able to realize what we've done here. And now we find ourselves in this emergency that we're just alerting each other to. Of course, nobody wants to hear that they're in an emergency. They'd much rather sit with the status. And that's one of the challenges that some of us have, folks that are writing about it and speaking about it and sharing about it, is that this is a story nobody wants to hear. The greatest story never heard.
Yeah, but I like to put to take the positive spin. It's like whenever there is a crisis, there is an opportunity. You know, we have the chance to be the best humans that have ever existed. I had an experience back in 1980 where I received some information psychically, let's put it that way, where I was shown what we've done to this planet over the course of thousands of years. I was shown it. And then I was told, and I was feeling a lot of despair, like, what do we do? And I know a lot of people who are coming across this material now are going to feel a lot of despair. They're going to say it's hopeless. And that's the way I was feeling at the time. And what I was told was, sure, it's hard, but always are we here helping you. It was as if we're not alone in this whole thing. We could only see the entities around us. We are only programmed as humans to see only what we can see within a certain spectrum of human apprehension, you know, perception. We can only see that. We don't know all of the life that exists in the universe. You know, there may be other dimensions, whatever. All I know is we were told that we're not alone. But not only that, but I'm not alone also in terms of the people who want to do something on this planet. That's the other thing, is that we don't know how many people like us there are out there who want to make a change. We don't know that because it's not like the media is going around saying, hey, we got a big problem and here's the people who are working on it. They're not, they're completely ignoring it. So we'll never know until the end, or till it's over, let's put it that way, how many people are actually working right now to change things on this planet.
Yeah, there's definitely an upswell of that energy, and has been for quite a while, I think, a continued growth, but an inability to connect in a way that can infiltrate this status quo media and Western lifestyle.
We'll never know. It's like it's going on under the surface, and at a certain point, it's like the leaven in the dough. It could affect everything, or it'll reach a certain tipping point. It could happen in an instant. And some of my other experiences have led me to believe that there is a possibility it could happen that fast.
Yeah.
You know, my altered state experiences, which I've been heavily involved in holotropic breath work and altered states work. You know, it's like going into into transpersonal spiritual states and getting information, and you know, you don't know how reliable it is, but some of it might just be very reliable.
Yeah, you know,
I was making is that what information I got was, sure, it's hard, but always are we here helping you, and not only that, but you're not the only one doing it.
Right,
there's many others doing it at this time in history.
Right, and you were saying in our last interview about how the best of humanity can show up in emergencies, and that seems to be what's being called forth now.
Absolutely. As I was saying, that there's a spiritual practice of having death as an ally. I mean, it's a very common one. I mean, it's one of the most common things that they do is they take people close to death to give them a death rebirth experience. It's, you know, this is the origin of the idea of baptism and things like that. Originally, that was actually coming, you know, close to drowning. Mm. And then you would have this, you feel your mortality, and that would wake you up to the seriousness of life and to get connecting with the deepest parts of yourself, which we might call God or source. All right. But at any rate, if nothing else, you could say that what happens when you face your demise, and your imminent demise, is it all of a sudden the things that you think are important to become trivial, because they are trivial, and the things that you thought were trivial that really are important become important. So it resets your priorities, and in a good way. Now, we've never had to have this happen on a global. This has never happened on a global scale. But ever since the 50s, with the nuclear weapons and everything, people have been more and more and more becoming aware that it could end at any moment. So there's been this increasing pressure for a spiritual awareness or a consciousness awakening been going on since the 50s, since the bomb. Now, the bomb's a terrible thing, but one thing it told us was that, hey, wake up, you know. Yeah. Now's the time to wake up. Now's the time to open that mind, you know, and become enlightened, become awakened, whatever. And what I'm saying is that what that means if you think about, you know, and I'm not talking about awakening in some intellectual sense or some, you know, woo-woo sense, you know. I'm talking about what I think of awakened is becoming that higher self, the best humanity that we are, which is, if you were to think about how you were, what you would do if you were going to die in another day, most likely you're going to be thinking about your loved ones. You're going to be thinking about what you might do for them. You might be thinking about what you might want to tell them before you go. You know, there's a lot of things that you might want to do, but I think that what most people would happen if they were going to die soon, they knew they were going to, their end was imminent, they would start to do the things that they've been putting off that involve their compassion, their love, their heart, you know, and their heroism. They would start to take risks to do things for a higher cause that they've always wanted to do but have been reluctant to do and been putting off.
Right.
And that's what I'm saying is what we need. So there's a coming together of this dire, you know, this catastrophe that's in the making. It's happening right now. It's going on. Extinction is going on at this incredibly rapid rate to where we're going to lose we're going to lose half of the species that exist within 20 to 50 years. And the oceans are dying and all that. At the same time, we have a growing awareness since the 50s that's causing people to become more spiritually awakened because they realize they got to do it in this lifetime because this is the lifetime to do it in. And, you know, and they have to do it not just for themselves but for their loved ones. And it's going to bring all that out. So how it's going to go, I don't know, but it's going to be an incredible – it's going to be an incredible story, if nothing else. I mean, and I think it's going to be incredible to be part of. I know that as depressed as I was when I first was aware of this, I have, you know, this has enriched my life that it said, I know I'm part of something big. Right. And I know that people who are aware of this, who get involved in it, they become part, they align themselves with a higher cause like this. They realize that they are part of something important. You realize how many people have lived lives where they felt like they were doing something that was unimportant? There's nothing more important than this. Nothing. Never has been.
Yeah, and our humanity, watching our humanity blossom to some degree or another, and that death and the knowing that there is an end happening inspires us in a whole new way. I mean, humans show up in powerful ways during emergencies, and so as we come to own the emergency that we are, then we get to go out in style is about what I was going to say. It feels a little too consumerist, but I think you get the point that if in fact this is the chapter that it is, whether it ends entirely or partially or whatever, I want the story of my life to have been that I came to realize it and I moved my energy in that direction, which is what Joanna Macy calls active hope. You know, it's not hoping for some certain outcome, but it's hoping that I will put all I got into all I'm being in this direction during this time.
That's a very good point. It's not just that it brings out your compassion and your love and all that, but it brings out your abilities, magnifies your abilities. I mean, like you say, in an emergency, you know, a father might be able to pick up a car if it falls on his child, you know?
Yeah.
Or something like that. Rip open a car door if his child's in an accident, may be able to rip. I've heard stories like this. I even know, you know, people in my family this has happened to. It's really common. It's like you get these superhuman powers when you're in an emergency because all of your being comes to focus on that. Now, to a certain extent, the more we realize that how dire this is, the more we realize that it does bring out our best, our greatest skills, our greatest talents, our greatest focus. So there's hope in all of that.
Yeah.
Not just in the way we feel about things and the love we exude, but that it brings out the best that we have to give. We come into this earth every time we are reincarnated. We come here to express whatever skills we bring into that life. Okay, so that's you know, that's what life is all about. It's like each life is an experiment in truth. We bring in certain skills that maybe we've accumulated from previous lifetimes or whatever, skills or tendencies or desires. We come in to realize them and to try them out. Well, in this lifetime, we have the greatest we have the greatest push to bring them out and manifest them most fully than ever.
Yeah. And that's such a beautiful thing, that this urgency, this emergency is causing us to experience our humanness in such a grander way. And I want to shift now to what's beyond that humanness. You wrote a book called Funny God. What's your God perspective in all this? What's God up to?
God's a trip, because God's us. You know? I also wrote Experience as Divinity, and from my understanding and my experience of consciousness, spirituality, and all that, and it's not all that uncommon. You know, we are all one, and that one is the all that is, and that all that is includes us. And it's not you know, we say we are stardust. Well, so what? I mean, it's like that's. Physically, we're stardust, but the important part about being stardust is that we are part of the universe. We are part of the reality of the universe. We're not separate trying to get to heaven. We're not separate trying to get to God. We are part of God. God is the all that is, and we're part of that. We have this tendency to think we're separate and we're fallen. No, we're part of God. But what we have done is we've forgotten that we're God. So I see as funny God, funny God is God's funny, because we as God, each one of us as God, decided to go and forget that we're God so as to have a trip. It's kind of like playing a game, you know? Like, you know, when you play a board game, you forget that the real world exists out there. You're playing Monopoly or whatever, and that's your reality for that moment. You have certain rules, and you know, you're operating with other people and other entities, you know, and it's a back and forth. It's fun. You want to see what they're going to do. But in order for it to be fun, you have to forget that you know it all. You know? You know even what they're going to do. It's not going to be fun if you know that what their next play is going to be and everything. So you have to limit yourself in order. It's like being, another analogy is to be an actor on a stage. So we are the actor on a stage playing a part. But we've forgotten our divine nature is that we are everything. We know that we're on a stage and all that. So that's what funny God is, the idea that what exists is pure consciousness, or as I call it, experience, because consciousness is not something mental. It's what we feel. It's all that we feel. When we have an experience, in a breathwork experience or something like that, we're experiencing something that's growthful. All of life is just experience, and that experience overlaps with other people. I mean, we are just a ball of experience, and we think we're separate. We've cordoned off separate areas of that, but those things, they mix. That's why there's telepathy. That's why there's all these other things. That's why you can feel that unity with other people. And ultimately, you can feel that unity with God, because we are part of that all, you know? And our boundaries can be either limited to like a human form, or they could be expanded to like ultimately to include the all that it is.
Right. And that's for me.
So that's what funny God is about the fact that we leave the Godhead for the fun of it. Okay. Because it makes it like, you know, knowledge by itself is just knowledge. It's not all that interesting, but knowledge plus time equals experience. And so we as God want to make everything greater, so we forget, so as to create experience and this incredible infinite variety of experience, which is God's grandeur, you know.
Yeah, that I love that analogies and the understanding that we know we're doing this to ourselves, but we've purposely forgotten that. We put the forgetting mechanism in so that we could have this innocence, this forgetting.
Yeah.
so that we could live in this space. And we also had to add, you mentioned time. Without this illusion of time, we couldn't have it this way. Because in the no time that the all one of us live in, right? There's no time. So there's nothing to miss. There's nothing to pass that way. And having a human lifetime would be like me saying, Michael, pretend you're an elephant for 1 second. Okay, thank you.
Exactly.
Right, that when we die, this is what I think, when we die is that we return to the remembering, and we're like, we still have the pen in our hand, and we're signing the paper that says, okay, I'm going to play this game, right? And that we're like, wait a minute, what happened? It's like, wait, I just lived this whole life. Yeah, I was Peter. And we're sitting there in the no time laughing at each other. He said, oh, no, for God's sakes, remember, we're still in the no time. You went into that time thing. So, of course, your fingers, your hand and the pen is still on the paper. There's no time. That was all a dream we made up.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, that's not too dissimilar from some of the spiritual literature, the stories you get out of India and so on, from going back thousands of years. It's like, yeah, there is something in us telling us, like putting out, like there's little breadcrumbs from the divine within us that's keep putting out this information, kind of giving us hints that, like, this is the real truth, you know, look over here. You know, this is all just an illusion. You're all, you know, you're just playing a game.
Right. And we're so
and
sure.
I think even the things that we do, I mean, if it's for so many analogies I have to what I think we do, it's like, for example, going to amusement parks, you know, like going or watching a horror film. Right. It's like, oh, it's horrible. But then why are we watching the darn movie? Well, because it's interesting and it's titillating. It's kind of gets you excited. It's interesting. So, like, God does all these horrible things, including the horrible things of life, because there's a part of him knows there's no real consequence. There's part of her that knows there's no real consequence. There's part of us that knows there's no real consequence. Since there is no death, that means that everything is ultimately a comedy. There is no tragedy. It's just a seeming tragedy.
Right. We sign up. You know? We get in line for the roller coaster to get scared and to go through the ups and downs and scream and yell and laugh. And we're fully in that experience. And then it's done. And we go, ha, wasn't that funny? No.
Exactly. You know, you talk about your butterfly eyes. It's like I'm thinking, yeah, at a certain point you wake up as a butterfly. And what I'm thinking is you wake up and you're laughing your butt off.
Yeah, that's what I think.
It was a trip. That's why I call it funny God. It's like, because it's all fun. What I say is that the thing that we share with the divine is laughter.
Right.
It's like we're constantly goofing on ourselves, playing this game of peekaboo, you know, where we're constantly scaring ourselves, you know, and then we're like, oh, there's no problem. It's fine. How many times has that happened in our life, you know?
Yeah.
How many times have we thought something was horrible and then all of a sudden the clouds part, the sky, you know, the sun comes down and we're happy again and we go, wow, okay, so that was all just to get me here.
Yeah.
And it's okay.
Yeah, and how do we live with this passion? How do we live? You mentioned butterfly eyes, which I used in a different interview, was this idea that if we're these caterpillars, but we somehow can remember that we're moving toward a butterfly state, that, and, you know, I imagine two caterpillars talking to each other and saying, you know, hey, no, really, what's going to happen is I'm going to climb up in the tree and get in this little cocoon and suffocate myself. And then when I come out, I'm going to be this beautiful multicolored flying thing, you know, and your buddy's like, sure, what have you been taking, you know, but there's a real life analogy. Talk about breadcrumbs left by the gods. There's an analogy right there in our human experience where something is this certain thing, a caterpillar. It appears to die and then it turns into something so much more beautiful and light and airy and all this stuff. And so can we see with our butterfly eyes while we're here in the quote caterpillar stage? And that possibility is what sparks me in my life right now is to see with my butterfly eyes. And I have this little jingle that stays with me that's just reminding me that my own breadcrumbs to drop on myself.
Yeah.
Whoosh.
In fact, I've used that analogy myself. It's like when I was in Funny God, I'm talking about the story of Gilgamesh and how we've completely got that wrong, and where Gilgamesh was looking for immortality. He actually got it. And the tragedy was he didn't realize he got it because we are immortal. He was looking for immortality. And what they taught him was that we are immortal. How did they do that? Well, they showed him a snake who shed his skin. Okay. Now, yeah. A snake shedding his skin is a symbol of immortality because it's kind of like when we have a life and we die, supposedly, it's like a shedding of a skin. We just go into another form. And the thing that we leave behind is the skin. Now, what I've been saying, in the book, is like we look at the skin and we say, oh, he's dead, he's gone, you know, the person's gone. But it's only because we can't see the snake that the new snake that left. Or in the case of the butterfly, can you just imagine the caterpillars and you see this one caterpillar is making this cocoon, right? And they're going, oh, he's gonna die, he's gonna be gone, right? She's gonna be gone. She's making her coffin. Oh, too bad. And why? Because they don't see the butterfly. They don't know what it is, that they don't know what happens afterwards. They don't have their own butterfly eyes, if you will.
Yeah.
So they don't know. They think it's the end. So aren't they a lot like us?
Yeah.
You know, like, because after all, we only see the things that we're programmed to see. You know, it's like if we're not used to seeing butterflies, we're only going to see caterpillars and coffins or cocoons, you know?
Yeah.
So we, and there are people, you know, there are people now who've had near-death experiences and stuff like that, or they're mediums or whatever, who are aware of people in the no-form state. They can even communicate with them, and they can tell you they're not gone. You know, I know some of these people, you know, it's like they're saying that they're not gone. You know, they're just in a different place. And it's just that we can't see them.
Yeah.
Just like those caterpillars cannot see the butterflies.
Yeah. That we're urging, we're attempting to evolve before our very eyes, if you will. And remember this part of us, remember the butterfly while we're still sitting here in the caterpillar state, and live with that knowing that the end isn't the end, and that we can have that glow. We can know that we are that light, flying, colorful being, even when we look like these heavy, dense beings, and that there's more, and how we live with that more. That knowing that there's stuff, something beyond my humanity is what creates the glow for me.
Yes. And I think how that fits all together with the extinction thing is I think that that we are being spurred to these realizations by the fact that it's so important. Now all our focus becomes on this lifetime to get it right. Like I said, I've been trying to get it right since the 60s. We had a whole generation trying to get it right. Even if it was wrong for thousands of years, we wanted to see if we could get it right. And we're still trying to. Yeah. But anyway, as an entire globe now, we're trying to get it right or else. And what I'm saying is that part of that death as an ally thing is we're having these realizations that some of us are realizing our butterfly eyes while we're still the caterpillar. Okay? So more and more of us are realizing we're immortal. Now, does that make us say, oh, it doesn't matter if the earth goes away? It doesn't matter if everybody dies? No, because our higher self, our immortal self, is also our compassionate self. It is love. And of course, as love, we don't want suffering. So it's we don't want suffering. Death is still not a good thing because it's a painful thing. You know, yeah. I mean, death can be fine. It could be just a transition. But when it's going to happen for billions of people, and if it's going to happen for 500 million a species, it's no longer just, oh, I'm accepting death. It's friggin' murder. It's murder on a scale beyond our wildest imaginings. Now, I personally don't want to go into the afterlife or into the no-form state knowing that I was part of the murder of an entire planet because I didn't do anything to help at the time. So I think that, yeah, we realize that we're actually free. There's nothing to worry about. But at the same time, it brings out our higher self to want to make this story the best one that could be with the least amount of suffering, you know, because we have our compassion. I mean, our basic nature is compassion, love and compassion.
Right. And that understanding the urgency and the emergency will bring that out in you.
Yes.
Our culture is so death phobic and grief phobic. We think that those are bad feelings to have.
Yeah.
But what we're coming to remember slowly but surely is that those things actually spark this new aspect, this grander aspect of humanity, is this remembering that it is temporary for us individually, and that sparks us to live more passionately.
Well said.
Whoosh, that was pretty good. Somebody write that down? That was good. We might have. I think we recorded that.
It's a good thing.
It's a good thing.
That was really well said in a nutshell there, yeah.
Well, thank you. And perfect timing as we're getting to the end of our talk here. Michael, what a joy to explore with you here on the show. And that's Michael Adzema, Adzema. Google him. There's a whole bunch of YouTubes and a whole bunch of his writing online. Michael, tell us what the most recent book is and what the next books are. I know you got a series coming out.
The most recent book is Funny God. It's a Tao of Funny God and the Mind's True Liberation. And the next one is Wounded Deer and Centaurs. It's The Necessary Hero. And I'm talking a lot about how this brings out the heroic in people. And it's The Necessary Hero in the Prenatal Matrix of Human Events. And what I'm talking about in that is that we're not only finding our spiritual nature, but we're finding our fundamental human nature, which is more positive and better than what we've been told. Human nature is all full of aggression and everything like that. But really, basically, our human nature, you know, below the pain or prior to the pain, is actually loving and beautiful. And that's linked in with The Necessary Hero. You know, we are going into a stage where we're going to have heroic people who are going to do incredible things and make a grand story, or else we're not. And it's going to be. We're going to be some footnote in the universal registry.
right. And the creatures who zip by Earth in future millennia say, oh, look down there. I heard about that place.
Yeah, well, you know, maybe they'll use this as a garbage dump or something. I don't know.
Who knows?
Well, it won't be that important, whatever it is. The epitaph will be stupid ape, you know?
No, they got to hit the like button. At least they have to say, well, at least it was fun to watch, or I don't know, some okay, quality.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Some
cosmically. It was a disaster movie.
It was fun to watch for a while, and sheesh, did you see them all run there at the end? Yeah.
Yeah, but lousy ending. Nobody lived.
Spoiler alert.
He even killed off the heroes. I mean, come on.
Spoiler alert, yes.
Yeah, really.
Michael Adzema, thank you very much. Look forward to talking to you again sometime very soon. And thank you, listeners of Extinction Radio.
It's been fun, Peter. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Michael and Peter. You're listening to Extinction Radio, broadcast Sundays on Activate Media at noon Pacific Time, 8 p.m. UK time. Archived episodes can be accessed at extinctionradio.org. And now, Peter will be interviewing Paul Beckwith with his weekly contribution. The internet was kind of funny this last week when Paul was interviewed, so every now and then he's going to sound like a Cylon. It was poor cell phone reception on the part of Peter, and I've edited out most of it, and every now and then you're going to hear a drop, and he's going to sound like a Cylon, and that had to do with cell phone coverage. Peter and Paul.
Welcome back to Extinction Radio. Peter Melton here with the weekly check-in from north of the border, if you happen to be in the USA, of course. And that's to our dear friend Paul Beckwith in Ottawa, Canada. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Peter. Nice talking to you this evening.
Yes, always a pleasure and always fun to just pull our strings and see what comes out of each other's mouths for a little 15-minute segment to air on the Extinction Radio. It's I like it that way. It's just whatever comes fresh right off the top. So I'm going to ask you, what's what's freshest on your mind in the world of climate change and methane and ice melting and all the wonderful stuff that's happening?
Well, I went to a sort of talk. I guess it was, you know, a long talk with questions and answers by a climate scientist. I don't know if I'll say his name, but he's at the Potsdam Institute. He's quite well known. He's quite, written lots of papers. He was a chapter, either the head or, a major contributor to the chapter in the IPCC report on sea level rise.
Ah.
I guess after his, he showed a lot of computer models showing sea level rise over time, and talked about, ice being gone, 2060, 2070, 2100 or so on. And, at the end of the talk, there were questions, of course. So I'm not going to let that go unchallenged.
Of course not.
So I said to him, okay, if I look at the, if one looks at the sea ice volume time series, so just the graph of sea ice volume, and we typically run from 1979 to the present because 1979 is the start of the satellite era, you see the best fit to the curve is an exponential curve dropping, and it reaches zero before the end of this decade, before 2020. So I said to him, I've shown this exact figure to like 5-year-olds and 10-year-olds, and I asked them, where does this curve go to zero? And without with no exception, they all say, oh, right here, and it's about before 2020. And then I say, well, look at all these these supposedly very smart people running computer models, and they do all kinds of stuff. They try to figure out exactly what's going on. And their curves go like break in the trend, and it invariably, shows that the ice sticks around for much longer. And I basically told this story to this guy, and he got extremely heated and irate and, hot under the collar. He apologized to me afterwards, saying, oh, I'm sorry, I got kind of upset and annoyed and mad. And I said, oh, don't worry about it. I said, I was probably the same way. And he said, no, you were nice and calm and collected and made it worse for him. But basically, I was, saying that, like, the IPCC model, the way they run, the way they do their business to get the best climate information out to the public is actually a bit of a disservice, because how can a report that's done every 7 years or so possibly be of value when the climate is rapidly changing? Year to year, we're seeing new surprises and new things. I said, surely the IPCC needs to revamp their model. And what about having a delta paper? Every year they have a paper, which shows all of the changes in the climate system since the previous year's document, right? And that way, at least they have a better chance of keeping up. I said, the other thing is, it doesn't make sense to keep having models and to keep saying things and forever having to increase them one way. Okay, that means there's a definite bias in all of these models to the conservative side. I mean, to have a good model, a series of models, you want some models to underpredict, some to overpredict, and then when you take the mean, you tend to get closer to reality. If every single model is underpredicting, then the mean will always be an underprediction. And what's the point of that? You're giving people, you're misleading people.
Yeah, so what happened? What did he say, or what was the outcome of that?
Well, I kind of got, there was no good answer to that, of course. the moderator was saying, okay, I think we better move on to another question, right? Sort of thing. I mean, I spoke to him after the session was over, got his business card, and I'm going to send him some stuff. And because also I brought up the fact that the IPCC, every model, every report, it shows that methane is not not a problem, right? It's not going to cause, huge, like it's not going to come up in large quantities. I mean, that's what they're assuming. And, the stake of the planet depends on, this not happening? How can we say that it's not going to happen, considering that it has happened in the past? You know, and about sea level rise, you know, I made the point, which we all know, that, you know, as soon as the IPCC report comes out, it's wrong in terms of sea level rise, right? I mean, they take the number, the best number at that time, and they say, okay, that number is not going to change too much, or it's going to change linearly. And then they come up with a number at 2100, which has no validity. So I said, you know, I look at the doubling period of the ice melt in Greenland and in Antarctica, and just take that number, you know, that we've had that hold for three or four doubling periods. You know, it's about 7 to 10 years, closer to 7 years, actually. So just go carry forward, and, you know, we're talking about 7 meters of sea level rise by 2070. And he said, oh, that's impossible. You know, the planet can't do that. It would take a lot longer. And I said, well, what about meltwater pulse 1A? This is a time period when there was very rapid sea level rise. In fact, it was 5 centimeters a year for, you know, over, so in 100 years, it's 5 meters. And this happened for about 50 meters ice. And this is even coming out of the last ice age in the winter at night with no light in the Arctic, that would slow down the melting significantly. But now, with our greenhouse gas blanket that's there 24/7, whether the sun's out or not, is still going to be trapping a lot of heat in the winter. So this isn't necessarily a good analogy. Like this underpredicts. So even though 5 centimeters occurred per year for hundreds of years, that we still are capable in today's climate system to exceed that, because we have that greenhouse gas blanket, which is operating 24/7. So anyway, I brought up these sort of things. I like being a bit of a rabble rouser, I think. In fact, when I was in kindergarten, it's funny because my mom kept all my reports from school. So I have this envelope and I, you know, look at it and it shows, you know, kindergarten. Paul's a good student, but he tends to tease the other students too much. Or Paul's a good student, but he tends to try to annoy the teacher by telling the teacher he's wrong or something. So I don't think I've changed much since kindergarten, I guess.
Well, good. We need people like you to dare to challenge these folks and to dare to throw this different perspective in, because like you said, a continuation of conservative estimates just doesn't get us anywhere. And here we are culminating to this Paris conference where we're hoping to have some kind of something happen. But if everybody's basing it on these conservative estimates, and then nothing's going to happen. What do you think is going to go on there?
Well, you know, I mean, we've got to keep trying, but, you know, what happened in 20 COPs, 20 conference of parties, meetings, not too much. So, you know, in the 21st, are we going to actually, you know, get something different happening? I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, if some statement was drafted by global leaders saying we're going to, by all the different countries, just something very simple, we will start a carbon tax. We're going to put a tax on carbon, or call it a fee and dividend, and we'll start at $0 and get every country to sign it, okay? Right, it's zero. It doesn't do anything. Why would somebody not sign it? And then go into negotiation and say, okay, what's the price going to be of it? You know, and after hard and fast negotiation, we get a price of $5 a ton or something, you know, ridiculously small that won't do anything. And then, you know, but there is a stipulation that you have to renegotiate this price every twice a year or something.
Right.
Right. And then we get another huge set of negotiations. Okay, we got it up to $10. And, you know, another city drops off the map from flooding. Right. We have a major synchronization of food failure. So we jack it up to $20 and then 30, you know, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, yeah, and then you don't need, and then you don't need Paris. You don't need Paris. You don't need thousands of people flying to Paris, you know, using up all that energy, et cetera, to get something going. So let's have this document, and I'm okay with the zero to start off.
There you go. That's creative. You know? That's that creative, feisty little guy there. Get things going, and then...
You just do something to get the ball rolling, so...
So, Paul, what's the latest in the methane world? I haven't touched base very much there recently.
Yeah, well, I'm going to be doing a analysis of what's happening in the methane world to answer this question. You know, within the next there's been some very interesting peer-reviewed papers that have come out by the Russians, sort of updating some of their measurements of methane coming out of the Eastern Siberian Arctic Shelf. There's also been some papers on basically the fact that many cities, many different places that use natural gas or that are, you know, fracking, you know, there's huge leak rates from these things. There's huge leak rates from fracturing, you know, it's no surprise. You fracture rock, you know, deep down to methane, it's released and it trickles up through the cracks and you extract some of it in your fracking towers, but there's a lot of it escapes, you know, which kind of negates the whole idea of using natural gas to replace coal. There's many, many leaks in infrastructure in cities because who owns a lot of the natural gas pipes in cities? Well, it's a natural gas company. And they're trying to sell as much gas as possible. So the bigger the hole in the pipe that's leaking, the better for them because the customers end up paying for that, right? Not the gas company. So, I mean, just simply tweaking it so that, you know, the customers only pay for exactly what they use as opposed to having all of these extra fees which cover the cost of the leaked gas. You know, just changing, tweaking things, giving people nudges to do the right thing can be very effective, you know, government policies. In terms of the Siberian, you know, the craters in Siberia, there seems to be more of them appearing and more of them, you know, they're becoming larger. They're letting out more methane. In fact, in some places they're concerned about possible, you know, explosions from the methane, which can affect regions around. I mean, my question is, when will these methane craters start appearing in Alaska? When will they start appearing in northern Canada? Because there's nothing really unique about Siberia. You know, it's not very fair that they get all of the methane craters and they don't appear in other parts where there's permafrost.
And they've proven that those craters are, or what relation does methane have to those craters? What have they proven on that?
Yeah, what's basically happening is there's areas of unfrozen permafrost within frozen areas. For example, if you're near a body of water or a river, there's going to be heat generated from that body of water. It can retain and give off a lot more heat, so the area, the ground around could be unfrozen, so you can have these so-called taliks, areas of unfrozen permafrost, or you can have these areas, you know, they can create features on the surface called tingos, which are sort of elevated areas, or they can create you know, if the methane builds up, the pressure builds up, then it can basically eject earth and cause this crater. And, you know, the debris from the crater is around the edge of the crater. So, yeah, it's definitely been attributed to methane. And we are getting more of these occurring. And, of course, there's papers in the last few years that make the argument that a 1.5 degree Celsius warming above the 1750 chart will be tons of methane. And, you know, we're already in the Arctic. You know, so the question is that number a global average temperature rise? Because we're pushing close to that this year. You know, it is warmer this year because it's an El Nino year, but we're like at least 0.9 degrees above, you know, on our way towards that 1.5. You know, if you talk about if that number is a local temperature, of course, the warming in the Arctic is being amplified. So we're reaching those sort of numbers. So it's just a matter of time before, you know, methane starts to become a big factor in the equation.
Right. But it's still pretty much not in the main equations that are happening. Is that correct?
That's right. It's not all of those models from the IPCC. which show temperature rise or ice melt or et cetera. Those are based on feedbacks that do not include methane. The view has been that methane will not come out significantly, you know, in the time frame that those things are modeled. And that's obviously, you know, completely inaccurate. And yeah. In fact, the group, Arctic Methane Emergency Group, of which I've been a member for many years, we're working on a formal complaint to the IPCC, to the process, and to, you know, to question, you know, why you can't ignore this methane. Like, what are you guys doing? what have you guys been smoking? No, it's very strange. And then, of course, the other thing that's happening, you know, on a more local level for me in Canada is we have our federal election on October 19th. Of course, the ruling party, the Conservative Party, call it the Harper Party, since, you know, he's got complete and absolute and utter control over all of the MPs. I mean, they can't say anything that they want to say. This election, they're not even allowed to go to debates. They're not allowed to go to debates. So any debates that are occurring between all the different parties, the NDP and the Liberals and the Green Party, et cetera, you know, there's an empty seat in the hall. They're actually leaving an empty seat. Some people are putting, you know, a stuffed animal or something on the seat. Because the Conservatives are not there. There's only a few cases where they're there. And they're saying, oh, well, we're out, you know, knocking on doors. It's more important than going to a debate that's televised. And, you know, it's absolute absurdity. So with any luck, we'll see the end of Harper. I mean, I don't want to jinx it by saying anything, but I'm you know, it looks like the Liberals under Trudeau have wind in their sails right now. But like I say, it's just, you know, Harper's got to be out of there. I mean, this guy is a complete Neanderthal, you know, a climate denier. It's, you know, he's selling out Canada's environmental laws. Lakes are no longer protected. Rivers are no longer protected. Like, this guy has actually changed environmental policies. And guess who's done the wording on the change in the environmental policy? It's his oil companies directly, with no changes, in fact. And, you know, omnibus budget bills are passed, like it's supposed to be a budget bill, and yet it's 400 pages of changes to anything and everything. And the opposition complain, and the budget bill is accepted in its entirety, hundreds of pages, without a comma or period or anything at all being changed in it. So Canada is not in a democracy right now. We're under the iron fist of Stephen Harper. So hopefully the story changes on October 19th, just in a few days.
Yeah, just a few days from now. Well, good luck with that. Thank you again for joining us and sharing the latest and greatest that's going through the brain of Paul Beckwith. And thank you much. And we'll be back with you again next week.
Yes. Well, thank you very much, Peter. It's always a pleasure, talking to you. Maybe it was a bit of too much of a rant tonight. Hey. I'll be better when the election's over.
There you go. All right, buddy. Good night.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you both for that wonderful conversation. And now it's time for the Poet Laureates of Doom. This week, Ivy Cohn is going to read one of her poems. Deba was real busy and couldn't get hers in time. And so here's Rex Eagle, Ivy Cohn, and of course, Benjamin the Donkey.
This is a poem written by Dark Poems Rising. The poem is currently being made into a song. Music currently being written. The poem, Doom On. Doom on, doom on, we doom on. We pedal down the street, looking for that special treat. Past vacant buildings we go, past vacant buildings we go. We are doomer girls, pedaling our merry way, scavenging things to show, scavenging things to show. Doom on, doom on, we doom on. Into vacant buildings we break, anything useful we take. Past vacant buildings we go, past vacant buildings we go. We are doomer girls, best tattoos they can make, scavenging things to show, doom on, doom on, we doom on. Smirnoff here, Jack Daniels there, bottles of Libby Gold in our care. Past vacant buildings we go. We are doomer girls, into abandoned liquor stores, scavenging things to show. Doom on, doom on, we doom on. We see clouds of doom coming from every vacant room. Past vacant buildings we go. We are doomer girls, biking back to Doomerville, with scavenged things to show. Doom on, doom on, we doom on.
Ivy Cohn here with a short poem that I wrote in 1983. Sun glint upon carpet of city at noon, dazzling. Yet, in the repetition of this metro urban suburban sprawl, I find sadness, sorrow, for humanity who has ceased to think in the midst of high tech. Well-dressed barbarians in ritual performance, caught in the dailiness, overwhelmed by it all. Their thread of life lost in glint upon glass, gleam of steel.
Hee-haw! The concept that right makes might isn't quite logically tight, because fantasied rights are won via fights, and in real life, might makes right. Which sex caused the end of our run? There's no need to blame either one. Whoever's the jerk, we'll divide up the work, and between us, we'll get the job done. Hee-haw!
Thank you, everyone. And now, one of my gems, local musician here in central Pennsylvania, good friend of mine, AAA Blues Band, performing Ice Cream Blues.
Satisfied. Love me, baby. Keep me satisfied. 'Cause a good woman's love keep a good man by your side. I know sometimes I'm salty, but your sugar sure is sweet. Sometimes that is salty, but your sugar sure is sweet. I'm craving what you're saving. Give me a little treat. Sunday, mama, two big scoops whipped cream and hot cherry on top. You're like an ice cream sundae, hot mama, two big scoops whipped cream, hot sauce and a cherry on top. I got a taste of your love, I don't ever wanna stop. help me, baby. Keep me satisfied. Ooh, yeah. Love me, love me, love me, baby. Keep me satisfied, yeah. Cause a good woman's love keep a good man by his side.
You're listening to Extinction Radio, broadcast Sundays, noon Pacific time, 8 p.m. UK time on activatemedia.org. Archived podcasts can be accessed at extinctionradio.org. Carolyn Baker wasn't able to send her weekly segment in because she's traveling and spreading the word. So Ivy Cohn will be reading an essay. Ivy?
Here is a short essay written by Maxine Marilyn Johnson in April of 2010. Holes in the Ground. I've lived on Coyote Street all my life in an old mining town set in the foothills of the Sierras. The word coyote, not named for the animal, although I heard many and many howling nearby in the nights of my childhood, but for the holes dug all over these rolling hills. Coyote mining, a method of digging down to hit an ancient strata of gold-bearing river gravels, and then, trusting to blind luck and profane prayers that the earth would not collapse over you, tunneling sideways to bring up buckets of rich sediment to pan out. It was a hard way to mine. Few men hit really rich pay dirt, and all of them left dangerous holes scattered over the countryside. I grew up with warnings ringing in my ears. Dangerous holes. Men seem to leave them in lots of places and for various reasons, but mostly for mining the riches of the earth. We have a dandy one going on at the moment, April of 2010, 1 mile down on the floor of the Gulf of Mexico, an unexpected accidental hole spouting light, sweet crude oil, the finest there is, at the rate of 5,000 barrels a day, 200,000 gallons if you're not up on your barrels, and practically unstoppable. But there are other kinds. In Indonesia a few years ago, a native gas company went exploratory drilling, as they are apt to do in poorer countries, without proper sheathing to protect the drill, and a what-the-hey attitude towards what they might hit. What they hit was hot mud, where the drill ruptured an old fault, and up it came, flowing hot, fast, and smelling of methane at the rate of an Olympic pool per hour. It is still flowing years later, and Western geologists say it may go on for 100 years. Mud has covered 10,000 homes, displaced 30,000 people, and formed a flat, oozing shield volcano called Lucy. Mud volcanoes are found scattered over the world. For example, Pakistan has many, and Yellowstone has little ones. But the one in Indonesia is growing into a monster and now puts out 100,000 cubic meters of mud a day. Whole villages no longer exist. Another example of careless holes in our thin, delicate Earth's crust is the coal mine on fire under what was once Centralia, Pennsylvania. The town is abandoned as fire creeps along cracks, faults, and tunnels, collapsing the overlaying ground here and there from time to time, impossible to extinguish, and frighteningly insidious. Some abandoned holes, like our deep rock gold mines, fill with water, icy cold and black. Hot, boiling water is the problem in other mines, and the heat of the earth's interior prevents excavated mines deeper than a mile or two, and thank goodness. However, the greed that drives material extraction leads only to much bigger holes, as men and machines combine to excavate open pit operations that change mountains of coal, etc., to barren valleys blasted down in stair steps. Inverted pyramids, if you would. drilling, as opposed to excavated mining, can go much deeper and get us into further trouble. The oil rig platforms are capable of drilling thousands of meters into the seafloor, risking many dangers: fire, explosion, mechanical accidents, storms, drifting off the drill line, leakage, and more. Since there are over 4,000 oil wells and some hundreds of rigs still drilling more off the Louisiana coast, the multiple of disastrous possibilities is boundless. In several other countries where offshore drilling is done, law requires a device that covers the wellhead when an accident wrecks the drill connection. No such steps have been put in force here, even though the Gulf is the richest coast in harm's way. If the leaks, the three of them identified so far, continue at or above the current rate, this could be the worst spill in history. Why do we drill dangerously 30,000 feet or more for oil that pollutes our world? Why are we pursuing more? To keep to 20,000 air flights a day in the air? For all of us to ride in chariots the pharaohs couldn't even dream of? While speaking of drilling small but lethal holes, two other considerations come to mind. One is subsidence. Drilling a modern well to break up irrigation water sounds like such a good idea, and it is, up to a point. But wildly adopting any successful thing and running it to extremes, usually for a profit, why, that's the American, or Chinese, or Indian, Australian, etc. way. Aquifers can be pumped down until the ground begins to settle. Oil wells in Southern California, water wells in New Mexico, the number of subsidences on the Earth's debit list could go on and on. The second is the extreme thinness of the habitable layer on this planet. Our atmosphere is relatively as thick as your breath on a mirror. The crustal zone has an equally thin Goldilocks layer, with temperatures just right for our survival. Some other life forms can exist way hotter or colder, in thermal sea zones or deep in rock. We keep finding life here and there. But our own slender hold on life depends on a minuscule band of surface, and it seems some of us keep punching holes in it without any thought for the future.
Thank you, Ivy. And now another one of my musical gems, my friend Andy Tolan's AAA Blues Band with AAA Swing. And this album, which was released in 1999, many, many years ago, won him the Best Unsigned Artist for Musicians Magazine. Unfortunately, Musicians Magazine went dark right after he won it, so he never got signed. Oh well. AAA Blues Band, AAA Swing. Thank you. That was great. And I get to listen to Andy most Friday nights at a local watering hole. And now, John Compost Cossum will be talking about foraging for mushrooms in the York, UK countryside. John?
Well, hello there, my friends at Extinction Radio. It's John Compost Cossum here. It's the autumn, if you hadn't have noticed, or fall, if you're American. But I don't understand what fall is, because I'm British. I do love the autumn, because it's the time when most of the crops come in that I'm interested in. So currently I'm drying loads of walnuts and hazelnuts, and I've found some almonds, and I've got apples and one or two pears, and that's about it at the moment, crops wise, or a few beans. But what I'm really enjoying at the moment is the foraging, the mushrooms. Now, I eat about 15 species of mushroom, and I'm pretty good at identifying the edible ones. And I think I could probably identify one or two poisonous ones as well. Now, there is a little saying about mushrooms. Someone who hunts mushrooms is called a mycologist. Or somebody who knows about mushrooms is called a mycologist. And here's the phrase. There are old mycologists and there are bold mycologists, but there are no old and bold mycologists. And what that means is that if you're going to eat mushrooms, you've got to be quite conservative. You're going to be very, very careful. Because it is possible to get poisoned. And there are one or two out there which are fatal. And some of them do look a bit like some edible species. Now, the edible species that I use are very, very distinct, and you can't go wrong, as far as I know anyway. One of the best eating is the oyster. It always grows on wood, even if the wood is slightly buried. And it's really easy to tell that. It's easy to tell it's an oyster, because the gills tend to go down the stem a little bit. And I've actually grown this from plugs that I've put into wood myself. One of the things that you sometimes find on grassland is called a shaggy ink cap or a lawyer's wig. And this is a rather nice mushroom because it's got a very delicate taste, and they grow very fast. They also disappear fast. And the way that they disappear is they auto-digest and turn into a black ink. And the proper name for that is to deliquesce, which is a fantastic word. And that black ink contains all the spores, and that washes into the grassland. And more ink cap mushrooms grow from that. The first mushroom that I grew, the first fungus that I foraged, is the honey fungus. Now, this is quite a damaging species because it can actually kill trees. And so if you find honey fungus in your orchard, then you've got a real problem because it will take one tree out after another. Now, I do have a bit of honey fungus in the garden. I spotted it in a very old willow tree. But the willow tree is in reasonably good shape, and I do pollard it every 4 years. Haven't had any fruiting bodies out of this honey fungus yet. I've just seen the bootlaces. The bootlace is the type of mycelium that grows through the ground and under bark. So I'm hoping actually not to see honey fungus growing on my willow, because I think that'll be the end of that willow. I have on occasions eaten a fungus called chicken of the woods. Now that's usually pretty good, but I had one about a year ago, and it made both my wife and myself a bit sick. So that wasn't very nice, and I haven't eaten it since. One of the nice things about mushrooms is they grow all year. You might think they just grow in the autumn, but some of them grow during the winter. And there's one called winter mushroom, or velvet shank, or enokitaki. And that is a bright orange mushroom that grows from branches and out of wood in the winter. And it's a really nice choice edible. Now, I have a very interesting mushroom that I grow on elder. Well, you can find it all over the place on mainly elder, sometimes alder. And it's called the wood ear. Now, these are very jelly-like. They're sometimes called a jelly ear. And they look a bit like ears. What you can do is you can dry them until they're crisp and then grind them up. And the dust that comes off the grinding, you can use that to thicken soups and stews because it absorbs such a huge amount of water. They don't really have a very good taste. I mean, they don't taste of anything. And they're a texture which might appeal to people who like oriental food. It's not really my cup of tea. I particularly like the fairy ring mushroom, Marasmus aureoides. And that's usually quite easy to tell what it is. And they're a tough little thing, very small mushroom. Quite tough, quite meaty. And another a much bigger one that I like growing out of grass is the parasol. I've been learning quite a lot about mushrooms recently through a couple of groups on Facebook, and I've just learned that in America there is a parasol with green spores, and we don't get those in Britain as far as I know, so I think that the two species of parasol we get here are both edible. Spore prints are one way you can differentiate between different sorts of mushrooms. What you do is you cut the cap off and put it on a piece of paper or on a piece of glass and wait a few hours, and then you can see the colour of the spores that fall onto the paper or the glass. And with some species it's one of the ways that you can differentiate them. I don't often find the boletus or penny bun or a sep, but they're a very nice chunky little mushroom, and as I said, I think I've probably had those just two or three times in my life. Another thing I found just once is a giant puffball. Now, these can grow to football size or bigger, allegedly to the size of a sheep. And I've only found that once, but it was so big that I was able to chop it up and share it amongst friends. There is a mushroom that I've had which is supposed to be edible, but I don't think it was very edible. It's called a stinkhorn, and it looks like a penis, and its Latin name is Phallus impudicus, so the devil's penis mushroom. And this stinkhorn, when it's mature, has a very smelly tip to it, and this attracts flies to it, which pick up the spores and take them off to wherever the flies are going. They grow from an egg that is filled with jelly, and that's what you're supposed to be able to eat. Now, I have had that once, and it was utterly disgusting. Today, though, I found a mushroom that I occasionally find in my garden, and this is what inspired me to do this little segment for Extinction Radio. I found a bluet, a wood bluet, and they're a lovely purple, kind of purple mushroom, really, and I get them growing in various different places in my garden. This one was under an apple tree, and they're a nice, meaty, good-flavoured mushroom. So, keep your eyes peeled. If you want to know more about mushrooms, then there are some very good field guides. I like to use Rogers, and it's a very, very, very good guide, but there are guides for different parts of the world. And then Facebook has a couple of groups, Mushroom Identification Group and the Mushroom Identification Forum, where you can post photos and a bit of information, and people will identify them for you if they can. And some of the time they get them right. So happy mushrooming. Enjoy your fungal forays, if that's what you're doing. And remember, mushrooms will outlive people.
Thank you, John. You're listening to ExtinctionRadio.org, broadcast Sundays, noon Pacific time, 8 p.m. UK time, on ActivateMedia.org. We're now going to have Solomon Amuzu present his segment. Solomon is a permaculturist in Ghana, and he's going to be talking about insects and the ecosystem. Solomon?
Hello, and thank you so much for making the day with us here again on Extinction Radio Permaculture segment with Solomon Amuzu. Natural ecosystem and its insect life is the topic for today. Insects and people are only part of the complex, interrelated world of life. Both are important, integral parts of its living dynamism. Insects are an important part of the diet for many birds, toads, and frogs, and for some insects in nature's complex food chain. The grow biointensive method reminds you that every time you relate to an insect, you are relating to the whole system of life, and that if you choose to dominate the insect population rather than work in harmony with it, part of the system dies. For example, we depend on insects to pollinate many of our vegetables, fruits, flowers, herbs, fibers, and cover crops. When we choose dominating, death-oriented control, then the scope and depth of our lives become narrower and smaller. We are actually detracting from our lives rather than adding to them. In trying to isolate an insect and deal with it separately out of relation to the ecosystem in which it lives, we work against nature, which in turn works against us in counterproductive results. When an excess of insects appear in garden, nature is indicating that a problem exists in the life of that garden. In each case, we need to become sensitive to the source of the imbalance. Observation and gentle action will produce the best results. In contrast, when a heavy-handed approach is taken and poisons are used, beneficial predators are killed, as well as the targeted harmful insects. Spraying trees to eliminate worms or beetles often results in a secondary outbreak of spider mite or aphid, because ladybugs and other predators cannot re-establish themselves as quickly as the destructive species. Paying attention to the soil and to plant health, planning a varied environment, and leaving a few wild species for unexpected benefactors minimize pests losses more effectively than the use of poison. Also, in order to have beneficial insects in your food producing area, you must provide a food for them which may be some of the harmful insects. If there are no harmful insects to feed them, then there will be few, if any, beneficial insects around to act as friendly guardians for your garden. This seeming paradox, the need of both kinds of insects for the most healthy garden, is symbolic of nature's balances. Not too much moisture, but enough. Not too much aeration, but enough. Not too many harmful insects, but enough. You find the need for these balances everywhere in the compost pile, in the soil, in the mini climate, and in the backyard microsystem as a whole. In a small backyard garden ecosystem or mini farm, it is especially important to welcome all life forms as much as possible. Thank you for making the day with us here on Extinction Radio Permaculture segment. I will see you again with a continuation under this topic. I am Solomon Amuzu. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Solomon. And now Ivy Kern will be presenting the extreme weather. Ivy?
Ivy Kern here with this week's extreme weather update. The criteria used by everyone from farmers to governments to predict normal weather patterns need to be updated more frequently to account for significant changes caused by climate change. UN's World Meteorological Organization's Commission for Climatology believes that rising temperatures and more frequent heat waves and heavy rains means that existing criteria, based on climate averages from 1961 to 1990, are out of date. The Commission's report highlighted growing concern among governments and businesses that climate change will disrupt not only the environment, but also entire economies and nations. Indonesia's gigantic fires are making global warming worse. Experts say that along with dramatic global coral bleaching, thousands of fires across Indonesia represents the next sign of an intensifying global El Niño event. And the consequences, in this case, could affect the entire globe's atmosphere. That's because a large number of Indonesia's currently raging fires are consuming ancient stores of carbon-rich peat, which is found in wetlands featuring organic layers full of dead and partially decomposed plant life. This year, the very smoky peat burning has been simply massive. The fires are estimated to have caused $14 billion in damage so far, and are causing hazardous air conditions in much of the area. Indeed, the 2015 Indonesian fire season has so far featured a stunning 94,192 fires. A new study has found that powerful winds are removing massive amounts of snow from parts of Antarctica, potentially boosting estimates of how much the continent might contribute to sea level rise. Up to now, scientists had thought that most snow scoured from parts of the continent was simply redeposited elsewhere on the surface. However, the new study shows that in certain parts, called scour zones, some 90%, an estimated 80 billion tons per year, is instead being vaporized and removed altogether. The finding means that scientists must adjust their models of how much mass Antarctica is losing and how much it might lose in the future. Climate change is thawing Arctic ground that was once frozen all year. making it a potentially potent new source of toxic mercury pollution in the region. Research published Friday in the journal Science found that Arctic permafrost contained high levels of the bacteria that transform inorganic mercury into hazardous methylmercury. With increasing temperatures, particularly in the northern latitudes, depths below the surface that were permafrost 10 and 20 years ago now annually freeze and thaw. Extreme weather systems bring heavy rainfall and severe flooding across parts of Italy and the Balkans. Strong thunderstorms accompanied with heavy rains and strong winds swept several regions across southern and central Italy, Sicily, western and northwestern Balkans during October of 14 and 15. Rough weather has caused floods and landslides across affected areas, especially in central and southern Italy. Typhoon Kopu will put lives and property across Luzon Island of the Philippines in danger this weekend and early into next week. Kopu developed into a typhoon early last Friday morning and is currently churning between Guam and the Philippines. Rapid intensification is likely to occur right before Kopu reaches Luzon. Kopu could become a significant typhoon, possibly the equivalent to a Category 3 or 4 hurricane. It snowed throughout the night in Moscow last week. The late summer warmth that had lingered for so long in western Russia was swept away dramatically. The cold air that caused the sudden change of season for Moscow had been blowing across northern Europe throughout the past week. The wind had been cold, but beyond Russia, it had been too dry to bring snow. This week, a big Mediterranean storm system swept vast amounts of rain into southeastern Europe, causing flooding in Italy, Albania, and Macedonia. This weather then fed into the cold air over Slovakia and Poland, and, rather than rain, snow started to fall. Mountains there rapidly accumulated 12 centimeters of snow, with elevations of about 900 meters. In southern Poland, they saw a day of snow accumulating 10 centimeters. Krakow, only 240 meters above sea level, also saw snow. Nature put on a spectacular display for beachgoers and lifeguards at Bronte Beach in Australia, where converging winds and warming water resulted in a waterspout at sea. It lasted for approximately 10 minutes. Waterspouts require a specific set of conditions to form, including upward-moving air, warming water, and a combination of winds. The rainy season finally started in earnest in Costa Rica in these last few weeks, and the arrival of heavy rains has municipal authorities scrambling to address the flooding and sinkholes that have become a seasonal headache for drivers and pedestrians alike. The latest sinkhole to appear this year was a 6-meter-wide, 11-meter-deep sinkhole that opened up over the weekend. 4 months of heavy snow are predicted for the UK, the worst winter in half a century. Britain should prepare for the worst winter in half a century, with advanced weather models now predicting months of heavy snowfall. Forecasters have issued early warnings to prepare for sub-zero temperatures and blizzard conditions across the entire UK. A perfect storm of ingredients, including the most powerful El Niño on record, and changes in air pressure over the Arctic threaten horrendous conditions across Britain. Tunguragua volcano in Ecuador has spewed gas and ash 2 kilometers into the air. The country's Geophysics Institute says the volcano shot out several bursts of gas and ash over the weekend, with one reaching more than a mile above the 16,475-foot summit. It also hurled incandescent rock onto its slope. Torrential downpours trigger flash floods and a deadly landslide in eastern Myanmar. Severe rainfall has been affecting Kaya State in eastern Myanmar over the last couple of days. Torrential downpours have caused strong flash floods and a violent landslide in the area. At least 17 people died and 60 homes have been devastated, while 360 people have been displaced by this landslide alone. Drivers flee as mudslides engulf nearly 200 vehicles near Tehachapi, California. More rain coming. Nearly 200 vehicles, including 75 tractor-trailers, are trapped on California 58 east of Tehachapi in up to 20 feet of mud and debris after torrential rains pummeled the area and forced drivers to flee. Multiple mudslides hammered the highway just east of Sand Canyon. Commuters were heavily traveling on Tehachapi Pass at the time. Authorities said 115 vehicles and 75 tractor trailers were swallowed by several feet of mud. Well, that's the extreme weather update for this week. I'm Ivy Cohn. You're listening to Extinction Radio.
I'm Gene Gibson, and I'd like to thank everybody for their presentations on this episode 30 of Extinction Radio. Hug your family. Hug your children. Hug your friends. Dance every day. Peace.